Today is December 12th, the year 2000. This is Beverly Woods talking to Mr. Fred Corrin. And what was your dad's name?
Cecil Corrin. He was born in the Isle of Man, over in the British Isles. He was a Manxman. You've heard of the Manx mm-hmm. cats? Well, the Isle of Man was where he was lived until he was about 12 or 13 years old. They came here in 1919 after World War I was over. They had originally planned to come earlier, but then the World War I, 1917, 1918, when it ended, they came in 1919.
How did they hear about this feat?
My grandfather had been a postal carrier in Her Majesty's service in England, and he got a spot on a lung, and they said he needed to get to a dry climate. So he came over way before they did and worked in the Bisbee mines.
Well, that couldn't have been good for his lungs, though, could it?
Well, I think the dry climate, he lived till he was 85.
So it was okay.
So he came out just fine.
Huh. So that's how they knew of Bisbee then, is because he was here.
Right, he came to the United States, I guess, about 1912. I'm not sure of the date, but around that time period. And a brother and a sister of my dad's came shortly thereafter, before World War I started. And they were here. But the rest of the family was still in British Isles on the island, Isle of Man. My father went to Bisbee High after going to a junior high in an area now that no one would know. It was called Cowan Ridge. There were schools in Lowell besides Lowell School. There was a hospital there and an ice plant. All of it, when I came along and got old enough to roam around, was in ruins. The foundations were there. Where the pit is now is where those places were located.
So even before the pit, it was pretty much ruins or abandoned?
That particular area, which was directly to the west of Phelps Dodge Junction Mine, was where there had been a hospital, ice plant, other buildings. I don't know what they were.
All company things, basically?
I don't know that they were all just company. Probably the hospital was, but the ice plant might have been some other group. Yes, there were communities there that a lot of the people would know about now, unless they've done a little reading in the mm-hmm. histories. There was Upper Lowell. There was Junction Row, that's where I lived, right across.
No, I never heard of that.
Yeah. It was where the buildings for the engineers were located, and the assay office for Phelps Dodge was located right next door. As a youngster, I'd get out and rummage through their garbage for samples. I think the engineers threw a lot of their things back there knowing that kids would come along. We'd get diamond drill cores where they'd be prospecting underground, drilling deep into to find if there was other more ore. We'd get nice samples of malachite, azurite,
really?
Turquoise, and I'd collect the crucibles that they had used in the assay office when they'd fire up their samples.
I have a couple of those I've found.
Oh, well. Yes, and Junction Row was where a lot of the different bosses lived. We were at number one Junction Row. My dad had to be there because of the mines flooding at different times, and he had to be available to open up the gates and let the big lime trucks come in so that they could pour the lime in to neutralize the copper acid water to keep from having the pumps destroyed. And then along that row was the head of their power plant. They had a, they generated their own electricity. They had a lovely plant, very clean and very modern at that time. Mm-hmm. And
where was the location exactly?
It was the Junction Mine is still there. The pit goes, the perimeter of the pit goes right up against where Junction Row was. You know now where those buildings are sitting on the edge of the pit?
Uh-huh.
Well, just to the west of those was where the homes were.
Huh.
There was Cowan Ridge, which had many homes over there. And a part of Lowell is not there anymore. There was the Lowell Women's Club. It was a big hall that they'd have dances and meetings in. We used it for the Boy Scout troop. We had our meetings there. It was a place they'd congregate in Lowell. There were other little areas like Mason Hill and Johnson Addition. There was a radio station on the perimeter where the pit is now. Railroad tracks that used to run around the pit. Speaking of pits, the first pit was Sacramento Pit, as opposed to now it's Lavender Pit. It took in the Sacramento Pit. My uncle Arnold Corin ran what we called a dinky, a little steam engine where they would haul the ore out of the Sacramento Pit.
In earlier days.
Huh? Yeah, he was an engineer on one of their little locomotives. So it goes way back.
So what year was it you were born?
1928.
And you had a lot of relatives around then?
Yes, I did.
Grew up
I
with
had,
a family?
Two uncles and one aunt. My grandmother raised me. And my aunt Ivy, who's still alive, she's 95, will soon be 96. She was like a mother to me at times too, and my grandmother wasn't available. So I had all that family around me.
What happened to your mother?
Well, my mother left my father when I was 2.5 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Those times, they didn't get along.
Well, it's lucky you had your grandmother and your aunt.
Right, Ivy. My grandmother was wonderful.
What was her name, her first name?
Margaret Corin. Her maiden name had been Hall, H-A-L-L. Her parents were from the Isle of Man also. Yeah, my grandfather, Frederick T. Corin, met my grandmother, Margaret Hall Corin, in the Isle of Man and had several children before he came over.
And then he sent for the rest of the family.
Right. Although my grandmother had been here when she was about 18. She was a caregiver to children, or like a...
Like a nanny?
A nanny, right. Mm-hmm. In Georgia and in Cleveland, Ohio.
Huh.
She came over as a teenager and then went back to the Isle of Man.
Well, Cornwall isn't on the Isle of Man, is it? That's a different place.
No, it's in the British Isles. Some of the cities in the Isle of Man would be Ramsey, Peel, Douglas. That's the ones that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Laxey, the Laxey Wheel is a noted thing there. The Isle of Man is also known for motorcycle races. They have annually a big worldwide event in motorcycle racing. It's now mainly a tourist area.
Would it have been coal mining when your grandfather was younger?
Mining, but I don't know whether it was coal mining or what it was.
That's where he started with his mining.
Well, he was a mail carrier.
Oh, that's right.
Postal service. I don't know whether he worked in the mines in his youth or not. But when he came here, he did. I have pictures of him. It was in the days before there were the hard hats. They wore big floppy brimmed felt or western type hat.
Huh.
And big handlebar mustaches. I have a picture of him standing in the drift. A drift is one of the tunnels that goes out laterally. He's standing there with a candlestick and a spike. That's with their light. There weren't any carbide lanterns. There weren't any battery-driven electrical lights on there. Well, they didn't have hard
hats. That's what I was just thinking about. They wouldn't even have that.
No.
Wow.
And beside my grandfather, who's standing on the narrow gauge railroad track to haul the ore out for the mine cars, his partner is coming up a manway from a level below, and he's got his head and upper torso protruding into the level my grandfather's standing on, and he's got a candlestick.
I've seen those candlesticks too, that they're iron and they can shove into the wall or hammer in.
Timbers, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the heavy country underground is timbered country, although they do have open stopes, but their raises, their manways are timbered, and the heavy country's timbered. It's interesting.
So you really grew up in a mining family then, and in the area that was all mines pretty much.
That's correct. My grandfather had been in the mines, although my dad was an oiler on some of their ore processing equipment, and worked his way up to be superintendent of the mine warehouse and supply department.
Uh-huh.
My uncle Arnold was a boilermaker. He worked with cutting iron and steel and making things. My uncle, although he was not in the mining area at all, he was a banker. He was manager of the Miners and Merchants Bank. It used to be on Main Street, a Miners and Merchants, and he worked there as a teller. Then they opened a Miners and Merchants Bank in Lowell. This is back when the town was booming.
Mm-hmm.
And he became manager of the Miners and Merchant Bank in Lowell.
Yeah, what was his first name?
Fred. I was named after him. Or Frederick, really.
Uh-huh. Well, did they live near you, too, when you were growing up?
At times, my uncle lived with us. He was a helper in supporting my grandmother, who raised me. He and my dad lived with my grandmother, and then I lived there too. And they brought the income into the home. She provided our care and made mighty fine meals.
What was she like? What was your grandmother like?
Oh, I loved her. She was so sweet and caring, but firm and gentle and firm, if that's possible. She set me straight on being right and doing good. Yeah, she was so good to me. Yeah, she survived until I came back from the military. And she lived for about 5 months after I got back.
Was her cooking English? I mean, was it?
Oh, yes. I was raised on the pasties.
Mm-hmm. Lucky you.
Beef pot pie. Some strange ones, too, though. Tongue. Beef tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Beef heart. She made a wonderful beef and barley stew, and her pies and pastries were delicious. She was a very good cook.
Yeah, I love those pasties. I think they're so good.
Right. A lot of people aren't familiar with pasties. I always look forward to when I see in the newspaper one of the churches, they have pasties available.
Yeah, too. We get those.
Yeah.
Didn't she make them for the different men to take in the mines, like your dad?
Probably in the early days she did, but I don't remember a lot of that.
What, I wonder what replaced the pasty in the miner's lunchbox? Just a sandwich?
Well, for me, I was a miner. I wasn't a miner, I was a mucker. That's the low level. I was a laborer. Phelps Dodge was very good about hiring young people out of high school. I worked for them on three different occasions. I worked in the mines before I went in the Army. There was a period of time from when I enlisted until they actually called me up. I joined the regular Army in about May, and I didn't get called up until October. So I worked in the mines as a mucker. And then when I came back from the service, I worked in the mines again as a mucker. And then I went off to college utilizing my GI Bill. And I came back one summer and helped with the moving of the homes from Upper Lowell and Jiggerville to Bakerville.
That must have been interesting.
It was. We helped set them up. And when I say we, there was Orrin Soles, Eddie King, George Barr. They helped erect them, level them, and put in improvements.
How did most people feel about that?
Well, it was a shock for a lot of them, but the Phelps Dodge, they paid for their homes and they moved them either to Bakerville or Saginaw. I worked on the ones in Bakerville, but a lot of my friends were later on in Saginaw. Some of the kids that I'd grown up with that lived in Upper Lowell and Jiggerville. Jiggerville was an area for bosses. They were called Jigger bosses, and it had to do with a mining term with regard to who was in charge. And they were moved then to along Bisbee Road. The house that I lived in as a boy is on Bisbee Road across from the Campbell Shaft.
Oh, it's the still Campbell there.
It's still there. Huh. There's all those houses of the bosses from Junction Road are still there. Albert D'Amico's home is there. He was in charge of the cables on the, people would call them elevators, but we called them cages. Mm-hmm. He went up and down in the cages to underground, and there were mine ore cars or dippers that brought the ore up. And he was in charge of the cables on all of those units to see that they were strong and safe.
That'd be a lot of responsibility to have.
Right.
What do you know what the address of your house is on Bisbee Road?
No, I don't. There's a cluster of homes there extending from just above the M&M housing area where the anniversary home is. Mm-hmm. From that intersection all the way up to across from the mine gate at Campbell, all of those homes were the homes on Junction Road. They were all prime, mm-hmm. wooden frame.
Did people have a choice where they got relocated?
I don't know the particulars, really. Mm-hmm. I had gone off to the service, and when I came back, I had been away at college, and I don't really know what went on. I know that.
Well, when you moved them, did you jack them up somehow and put like a flat bed under it, or how did they do that?
We were in charge of when they brought them in. So there was a company, and maybe it was Phelps Dodge Company, I don't know, but they had big flatbed trucks, and they also had trailer type where they were, there were supporting beams, stringers, long stringers that they had put underneath those homes. Probably they had jacked them up, but I was where they would bring them in.
So you had to get them off.
Eddie King and Orrin Soles and I, we would see that they were level. We would put the supports underneath those homes. We would put them posts and pillars and footings, mm-hmm. and level the floors. And then after that, they improved a lot of them. They put porches on those that didn't have it. They sheetrocked them inside and painted them all up nice.
Well, tell me about when you were working in the mines. Was there a lot of teasing and fooling around that went on?
Well, let's see. Well, yes, when you first hire on, well, let me tell you about the hiring on. The jobs were scarce, and there'd be long lines. A friend of mine a boy from Malid's grocery store, which is no longer here, in Upper Old Bisbee.
Yeah, I never heard of that.
We went down in the mornings and we what they call rustle for a job, rustling, and get in that line, and we were not selected. So finally we decided we're going to get in the front of that line. So we stayed out all night on the porch of the hiring office, out on the steps, with a little coffee and a deck of cards. We played cards, and we stayed all night, and we were hired. We got on. But then going to, when you start, you have on a clean union suit, one of those BVDs. That's what the miners, it would absorb perspiration, and you'd have on that on, a pair of Levi's, but it marked you, a nice brand new helmet or hard hat, and the unions, the white, pretty white union suit. They'd get you on the cage, and the cager would ring the bell, the signals and codes. They'd drop that thing out from underneath you. All the miners are watching the young fellows.
Whoa, looking for their reaction.
Right, your stomach goes up in your throat, and they'd laugh. And there was a lot of good camaraderie, good friendship. I can remember when we came back up, Jimmy Malid, he was a joker. He'd been working in a sulfide stove. And when you drill in that, you get very black. And he had this black all over him, and the nice new shirt was all black. He came in the change room after shift, and he drops to one knee, and he says, "Mammy, how I love you." You know, pretending like Al Jolson. Yeah. But they were very good to us. You earned your money, but it was pretty good pay.
Mucking was awfully hard, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. They test you to see. One of the first jobs I'd usually put you on was copper water ditch. There's drainage ditch alongside the little railroad tracks, and copper mud running in there, and water. You'd have to keep that clean and clear where it would run. Also, they'd put you on maybe working with moving the gob. Gob is the waste, where they fill in an area that's been mined out, and they bring in this waste that they don't want to ship to the surface, and they fill in areas that have perhaps not been supported by timbers, and they fill it right up to where, so it won't cave. That gob replaces the area that's been mined out and vacated. Right, and you would shovel and shovel and shovel and shovel. And then as you progress, they were good, at least with me, in putting you into different jobs. Like, I was a powder monkey, that's carrying the dynamite around to the stopes where they would be working the ore.
Is that kind of scary?
At first, I didn't really know very much about it, but I wasn't actually into that. The scary part was when I was with some miners, and I can remember we drilled out around and were ready to blast, and they have the sticks of dynamite. You take a wooden skewer and you poke a hole in the stick. You then insert the blasting cap in there and tie it to the stick. And the fuse comes back out of the hole. You take the wooden stick and tamp it into the hole. And I thought, oh, it seemed like they could make it go off. But the cap is not that sensitive. And then you add the rest of the sticks, and they time them, and being green and new to the job, you don't know. They're cutting the fuses to different lengths so that certain holes that are shorter will go off first. Mm-hmm. And the fuses that have longer fuses will go off later. One of the last set of holes to blow is the what they call the lifters, the bottom hole where you've drilled out in this drift or in the stope, and they go off last. But as a young fella, they've cut the fuses and they get out a spitter, which is like a sparkler.
Mm-hmm.
They ignite it and they start touching the ends of these fuses. and you're ready to go, you know, let's get out of here. But they're so casual about it. They stroll along and go get their denim jackets and put them on and grab their lunchbox. And they're walking along casually down the drift or out of the manway. You're ready to run.
Dynamite going behind you.
Right, yeah. But you soon find out that those fuses, they go for a long time. And then they'd station you in the drift or on the upper, the top of one manway or the bottom if you're in a manway. Or if you're in a drift, one down the drift and one up the drift. And you would call out, fire in the hole, fire in the hole. You'd stop anybody that came into that area until you heard them go off. And then they'd try to count the rounds so that if there's any dynamite that didn't go off, they could let the next shift know that there might be a cap in there that hasn't exploded. Uh-huh. And then when you get the big heavy metal rakes moving over that, that could be dangerous. So they watch for the holes that didn't go off.
Did that happen often?
I don't really recall. Not on my shift. We worked mainly day shift and night shift. There were graveyard shifts, but I wasn't on that. It was interesting. I actually enjoyed it. Tool nipper, that's where you take the tools to the drills, the drill bits, the steel drill rods, the machines. I can remember one of them was called a DA-35, and there were ones that were moved into the face of the drill area by hand, and there were others that were automatic. You just turn them on and they'd move the steel forward, and they had what they called Timken bits, tungsten carbide bits. I worked with a timberman. We'd go into some areas that were very wet and moist, and the timbers had to be replaced frequently. And we'd go in there and shore it up, putting what they call spining in the roof, support timbers on the side, some of them like 8x8s and 10x10s, big heavy timbers. They'd all been what they call Wulmanized. That is to prevent rot and decay. It was interesting.
Do all the tunnels connect at some point? You know,
well, there's different levels. Like my first level I worked on was the 1800 foot level, and that was near a precipitation plant where they were putting metal cans into big vats that had copper water in them and keeping the ditches clean. That's where I was at. That was the 1800. Later on, I worked at the 19, the 22, the 24, and I think at the junction went down to about the 2700 foot level. On each of those levels, which are about 100 feet apart, they have tunnels running every which way. And of course, most of them go back to the shaft, the cages area. And they had big bins that they dumped the ore into to be hauled to the surface, deprocessed in the mill or in the smelter. And not all of the tunnels connect. One might go south, one might go east or west underground. And it would go out to the various raises and stopes and manways. They'd pull their little train in underneath a chute, lift the chute, door it open, and all the ore would come down into the ore car. I worked as a swamper on the motor cars.
What is that then?
A swamper is the one, is a motorman who drives these little cars right out here in front of the museum. That's what I worked on, that little railroad. The swamper is the one who dumps the cars. Also, he lines it up underneath the chutes that they're going to pull to put ore into the cars. You help throw the switches, if there are any, where you need to go from one main tunnel off into another. You have to get up there and flip that switch to go in.
Seems like it'd be easy to get lost under there.
Well, you're usually in a small area that you work as a miner, although as a tool nipper or as a powder monkey, you get around a little bit and you just learn to recognize the different areas after a while. And then they did have the stopes with numbers and names on them. I mean, letters and numbers and letters.
Was the temperatures different? Aren't there mines that are hotter?
Right.
Like isn't the Oliver?
I worked in them where it's wet and moist and hot, dry and dusty, although they tried to keep the dust down best they could. Some with a little cool breeze, if you've been working with your union suit on and working up a sweat shoveling or picking. I heard
stories of people pouring sweat out of their boots.
That problem.
Okay.
So after you've been there a while and you get put on a job where you're tool nipping or carrying the dynamite to the places, you become familiar with the drifts or tunnels, as you'd call them, and where they go, and how to get back to the main shaft. You know your working area, and after a while you know the other guys' working areas. You'd assemble for lunch, sometimes in a little area where you'd left your lunch bucket, and lagging is 2-inch thick timbers that maybe you'd have a little 8x8 block, and you'd put your lagging on that block, and you'd sit back and recline and have lunch, and like a little lunch room where we'd all assemble and get our lunches out. There's usually water out there, fresh water, and salt tablets. The PD was great on keeping you from losing the salt from your body. They'd supply salt tablets for you. They treated us very well. Yeah, they did a lot for this town. A lot of people don't realize. Some of the environmentalists complain about the dumps. Well, there wouldn't be a Bisbee if there hadn't been those mine dumps. And they were good to support projects for the kids. They did all sorts of things. They supported the schools, and they provided equipment, people, and they were wonderful.
Yeah. It was like the YWCA.
They helped the YM. I was a boy that went to the YM.
Oh,
I learned to swim there. There's a pool in the basement.
I remember that pool.
Yeah, I can remember going through the various stages. I think there was a jellyfish pollywog. I think the top of the line was when you became a shark or became a lifesaver. There were some of them that went on into lifesaving.
Huh. Well, was the pool up on Higgins Hill at that time then? Is that
no,
before that?
Back in my time, the pool was up at Laughlin Avenue.
Oh, yeah, I heard how cold that is.
Oh,
that's what everybody talks about.
Right, that was cold. The wind blew through there. But it was a nice facility. It had a big, deep end where there were towers and swings that you could get on and dive. And then they had a cement wall separated the area where maybe it was like 3 feet or less for the little people. And then there was a middle area between the diving zone and the deep, deep part that was about 5 foot deep, and there was a cable that went across. And then there was the cement wall where that area was for like intermediate swimmers. And they had a grandstand where the people could sit,
oh, really?
Sit and observe the swimmers. They had nice change rooms. They also had a central area, similar to the Higgins Hill one, where they had refreshments and baskets to put your clothing in for security. It was a nice place, but it was cold.
Water.
Yeah, Higgins Hill came along a lot later.
But so at the time there was that one up on Lockwood, there was also in the YMCA.
Right, the YMCA here on Howell Avenue, there was a little gym. I learned to play basketball in there. We had city basketball teams. We played within the city, and then if you got into the gold medal tournament, which was through the YMCA. Your team, if you advance, you finally become the champions. We would take on other cities. I was fortunate to be on a team like that. We were the city champs, and we played Douglas. I remember beating them with their YMCA team. This wasn't the high school. This was YMCA. I went to camp. They had what they call Raggers Camp, and you go through various kerchiefs, white and blue and brown. We went to Rucker Canyon. We'd have our boys, our YMCA camp there. Later on, there was a Boy Scout camp up at Rustler's Park. And when I was in my teens, I was a counselor there.
Do you have tents? Do you have to set up tents?
No. Open. We'd slept out at the Raggers camp and the YMCA, I mean the Boy Scout camp, there were tents. But we'd make our pine needle bed for our mattress up at Rucker Canyon and put a tarp and then our sleeping bags, or some of us in those days, we'd make our own sleeping bag with great big blanket pins and fold our blankets and make a sleeping sack.
Like a sugin, isn't that what they call it for the cowboys?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was great fun. And also you learned a lot, how to get along and how to take care of the environment and have a clean camp. We compete for awards. You get a U.S. flag to post on your camp if your camp got the top honor. And then it was great fun, like most camps, singing around the campfire at night, telling stories.
Well, at Rustler's, were there some buildings like?
There was what we called the bathtub, a little tiny swimming pool, and the change room area. Also, the part I was in charge of was the dining hall, and I'd get all the troop, they'd take turns setting the tables in the evening, clearing them off afterwards, putting out the bread on the table, the fruit, the milk, and then they'd go through a line to get their entree and their vegetables.
Well, this summer we were camping up at Rustler's and we did some hiking around and I think found the foundations.
Right up on the very top of the knoll, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Later they built one down below the lookout station, Camp Victoria. But in our day it was, I don't know that it even had a name, it was Boy Scout Camp. And the bathtub was very tiny, our swimming hole.
But it was cold, though, up
it
there.
It was, too.
It was
right?
Pretty chilly.
But the area is so beautiful with the pine trees,
yeah.
And deer, even had bear up there, turkeys. Yeah, I had a good youth. I've been very fortunate. Bisbee High had a good educational program. I went to Lowell School 8 years, then Bisbee High.
What year was it you graduated?
46. Yeah, I enjoyed it all. A lot of nice teachers. They did a good job of preparing us. I often look back, even on the tough ones that I didn't like, and I bless them now because it helped prepare me.
Yeah. And that's where you met your wife then?
Yes. Met my wife when she was a pretty little sophomore and I was a junior, and we went together till I went off in the military. I enlisted in May of 46 and went in the service in October and didn't get back here till 48. And we were married then about a month after I got back, and had she survived, she died 3 years ago this coming January, had she survived for two more months, we'd have celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary. So we actually knew each other and had gone together longer than 50 years.
Yeah. What was her name?
Madeline. Her maiden name was Malcolm. It was Madeline Malcolm. And her dad was Charlie Malcolm, who was very prominent here as a all-around person. He was a boxer, tough. He was in the contest for mucking and drilling. He was a cattle inspector. He was in charge of the county highways at one time. He was an all-around fellow, and I never did get to know him. He died when Madeline, my wife, he was her, passed away when she was 13. Yeah, he's quite a guy. Oh, an excellent bowler. They said he bowled 300 games.
Sounds like a man of many talents.
Right. The mother was Nellie Malcolm. She was bailiff for Jack Howard, and worked with the sheriff's department, and worked in the courts as bailiff up into her elderly years. Yeah, Madeline had a sister named Abby, who married Clyde Biglow, Abby Biglow.
Oh, I remember her.
And another sister, Jessie. She worked at the Bisbee Daily Review up until they closed it. And then there's Ruth Hoppy, another sister who's still alive.
Good sized family. I didn't ask if you had any brothers or sisters. I assume you didn't.
No, I have no brothers. I have a lot of half brothers, half sisters. Or did have, some of them have died.
Your dad remarried then?
My mother remarried.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. She had, I think, a total of 9 children.
But did
I was her first.
You were the first.
I was her first. Yeah.
So then what happened after high school?
Well, in the military, went in 46, got out in 48. Came back, worked in the mines. Short period I worked at El Paso Natural Gas because the mines weren't hiring. In Wilcox, they were putting in a natural gas pump station. I was hired on as an apprentice carpenter and found out that it was a group that did other things. When they needed laborers, they would come get the apprentice carpenters to go push cement wheelbarrows. But I did learn a little bit about framing and putting up sheetrock. And when they didn't need laborers, we did do carpentry work. And then I got word that they were hiring, and so I quit that job. I was kind of glad to get out of it. It was a 10-hour day, 7 days a week, no days off.
My gosh, how could anybody do that? That hard work.
It was tough, and we'd ride in an old flatbed truck go to the job with the canvas flapping and the dust boiling up around us.
It is dusty out there.
Yeah, my wife and I hadn't been married very long. We had what they call a wing foot. It was a little small trailer with an extension for the bed area. She wasn't too happy over there. We were glad to get back to Bisbee.
I bet. And her family would have been here too.
And so that was my second job with Phelps Dodge. And I went off to college, came back one summer, but I also worked at Fort Huachuca in the same capacity as what I had been in the service. I was a message center clerk, and all the incoming mail and Twixes, the TWX, like teletype stuff, came through our office. And crypto was right next door, but I wasn't in crypto. And we would route all the mail and all the Twixes. And when I came back, I worked in post headquarters at Fort Huachuca, headquarters and headquarters company. And that's what I had done overseas. I was stationed in Alaska I was an Army person attached to the Air Force. It was the Alaskan Air Command, and it was located on Adak in the Aleutian Islands. We were about 200 miles from Russia, and we had a big air base there. And I went off to school using that GI Bill, came back here when they were moving the houses and worked on those houses that summer, worked at Fort Huachuca other summers. I think I was out there three summers. First was a message center clerk. Next I was into mathematics and they put me in data reduction. There were no computers. We were the computers.
Or calculators.
Right. We had Friedens and Marchant calculators, and we would run all the data through there with regard to the drones and communication cables and lines. Wow. Telephone operator occupancy was one of the big studies. Running lines in the stream bed, in the air, underground, over hot rocks, testing how they'd hold up. The next year I came back, I was in charge of a group of college people and high school students that were doing the same thing again. But I came back and I had, I think, about 11 or 17 people underneath me that were college, all math people. And we would do the statistics on all those electronic projects. And then I finished up, got my bachelor's and came back and taught here. And then went back, got my master's and taught for 24 and a half years in Bisbee High in math. And the beginning years, science. The beginning years, it was general math and general science. You have to serve your time. You work your way up. Went from general math to algebra one and then algebra two and geometry and trigonometry.
So what years did you teach, roughly, if you remember?
I started in 51 up here at Horace Mann School, which is now part of the county administration building. Taught there 7th grade and 8th grade, then they moved me up to the high school on the hill, the old high school. Taught there then until we moved to the new high school. We still call it the new, and yes, we moved in
40
there.
40 years ago,
yeah,
now,
right? Right. We moved in there in 59. The beginning of 59, we moved over the Christmas holidays. The end of 58 and the beginning of 59. And
well, that must then have been exciting. What a big change.
Oh, it was so nice. We loved those big, airy rooms.
Room to park.
Oh, it was, right. It was lovely. And still is. It's been a good building. It's held up well over the years. Right, it still looks modern.
Yeah, it does. It's a nice school.
Yeah, 59. And here we are in 2000. Soon to be 2001.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Right.
So what year did you finish teaching there then?
Well, they moved me up into administration. It was 77. I was to work under Vince Byrne for half a year and get trained, but his wife died before the semester I was to begin. I taught my last year at Bisbee High, a half a year, and in the mornings I'd go to the administration building, which was in the old high school, and get an hour or so in with him. Vince Byrne was the assistant superintendent then. And then I go up after school each day and try to get some more training. But I was scheduled in January to not be a teacher anymore and be with him the remainder of that year and develop the budget. His wife died in December. He quit. He says, I can't carry on. And so I started in January, and thanks to a nice office staff and a good buddy who was a superintendent out in Palominas, he helped me develop the budget, Gene Brust. And we put that first budget together. It turned out all right.
That's kind of scary, though, when you have to miss your training time and just jump right in.
I had been doing college training because my master's degree, I'd obtained it in about 1954 in New Mexico and with extension courses from the U of A. But then in Arizona, they have different requirements. So my master's had been in supervision and administration, and I got into supervision and administration without all of the requirements. So then I went back to the U of A, and I took a lot of extension courses and even attended there in computers prior to my getting the job, and got my certificate through the U of A. They called it an endorsement. They endorsed my administrative certificate for a superintendent's certificate. So when I had been in the job about a year, I was assistant to the superintendent in charge of business affairs. They later changed the title to what Ron Olander now does, director of business affairs. And you handle all the ordering and budgets.
And you were telling me about the computers, about working with that.
Yes.
Responsible for that.
That was interesting. One of the men that was in charge of NDA, National Defense Act, he came through and he says, how'd you like to go back to school? And I said, well, I don't know about that. And he says, you get a stipend and it's in computers. And boy, my ears perked up. Computers? I'd love to. So they picked me and one of my teachers. I was head of the math department there at Bisbee High. And we'd drive over to the U of A every Monday. And we'd stay there until they'd kick us out of the lab about 11 o'clock at night.
Boy, and have to come home.
Oh, and a surprise, when I got in that lab, one of the students at the U of A was in charge of the lab. He was attending, and he'd been one of my boys in
my
math,
goodness.
Donald Brandt, and got experience in how to program and how to run computers. In those days, it was all punch card application. We'd punch our cards and run a deck through a computer, through sorters and collators and all of that. It was all key punch cards, and from that progressed into the PCs, the personal computers. I was fortunate that I had a board that went along with me, a good school board. We put computers into high school first, then we put them in Greenway and Lowell, and so in those mid-70s, that's what I was into. In fact, that was the bright part of my day after you've taught trig and solid geometry and algebra 2 for about 23 years or so. The computer was interesting, new, and the kids loved it. They were in my room before school and after school.
Oh, that is neat.
Yeah, it was a good experience, and it's helped me through other times in my life. When I retired from Bisbee, I thought, this is it, I've had enough. But Mr. Bruss said, hey, how about putting my computers that I need out for bid, writing me a bid and putting them out? So I did that. And then I recommended what to award the bid, what company. It was IBM. Theirs was the best product and the best price. And then he said, why don't you stay on and help install that? And I did.
One thing led to the next.
And then after we got it installed, he says, how about assisting running those? So after I retired from Bisbee in 86, I actually worked at Palominas. After about a year gone by, I started there, and I ran or helped with their computers until 91.
I know he had a wonderful school going out there.
Oh, it is.
I don't know if kind he's gone now, I guess. He's
retired.
I don't know if it's the same, but I know.
But he set all the policies and the background. It was rather traditional, but I lean towards the old ideas of firmness. My motto when I taught was firm but fair. And I tell the kids, you'll be tough, it'll be tough. But everybody in my class is the same. I don't care if you're my relative or the best football player in the world or a school board member's son or daughter. In here, you're all equal. And I'll be firm with you, but I'll always be fair.
I think that's a good outlook.
Yeah, and in Palominas, they have those old traditional type things. They have incentives for the kids to work toward, recognition when they do well. They have the Hands Across the Border program. They have a trip to a river, Arispe, a fishing outing.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, he had a good school system. A lot of people were wishing they had their youngsters in there.
Yeah, I know it was really popular, and I know it got quite large. Well, we have a little bit of tape left. Is there anything else we should talk about before we get into tennis? I thought for tennis we'd put in a whole new tape devoted to that, if you're amenable to that.
Well, I'll just say I enjoyed teaching. I liked working with those young people, and I must admit, I missed it when I went into administration. I liked the closeness to the young people and associating with them. I think it helps keep you young.
That's true.
And they were a joy and a delight, and a lot of them went on to do some great things. Bonuses of teaching have come back from those youngsters. They send me emails, and they write me notes and letters, and it was a good time. I feel fortunate that all the years were here in Bisbee. Came here for a very low salary, $2,850 for the year.
Wow.
In those days, you had to work somewhere else. That's why I worked at Fort Huachuca and in the mines.
That's amazing.
But it was a good experience,
and
teaching and administration. It's good. I got into administration because then I improved my retirement. I could see, on a teacher's salary, I'm not going to have a very good retirement, even though I've worked 24 and a half years. So I went into the administration, worked there 9 and a half, and wound up with a very good retirement.
And that was at the time when Bisbee schools were kind of at their peak, don't you think?
Yes, we had an auditorium that would seat about 900 to 1,000, and we almost fulfilled that thing. In fact, I think some days we were wondering, if everybody came to school that day, where would we put them all when we'd have an assembly?
Yeah.
Yes, those were the boom years. Over 800, probably over 900, I'm not sure. But now it's dwindled down to probably 400 or less.
I didn't know how many there were. It was a lot less.
And part of that count are the kids from NACO, which are true tuition students, because they don't have a high school.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're tuition students. And some Palominas youngsters, although since our school's diminished in size, I think a lot of the Palominas youngsters go to Sierra Vista now. They have more course offerings.
Be about equal distance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Close to.
Mm-hmm. Right. Teaching was great. Administration was fine also. A little more stressful, but it was a good experience and improved my retirement. That's about it.
Okay, well then I'm going to sign us off on this tape.